89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. Grammarly is the right AI assistant for your team. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Book 8, chapters 4 to 6 of 10 books on architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 books on architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 4. Tests of good water. 1. Springs should be tested and proved in advance in the following ways. If they run free and open, inspect and observe the physique of the people who dwell in the vicinity before beginning to conduct the water, and if their frames are strong, their complexions fresh, legs sound, and eyes clear, the springs deserve complete approval. If it is a spring just dug out, its water is excellent if it can be sprinkled into a Corinthian vase or into any other sort made of good bronze without leaving a spot on it. Again, if such water is boiled in a bronze cauldron, afterwards left for a time, and then poured off without sand or mud being found at the bottom of the cauldron, that water also will have proved its excellence. 2. And if green vegetables cook quickly when put into a vessel of such water and set over a fire, it will be a proof that the water is good and wholesome. Likewise, if the water in the spring is itself limpid and clear, if there is no growth of moss or reeds where it spreads and flows, and if its bed is not polluted by filth of any sort but has a clean appearance, these signs indicate that the water is light and wholesome in the highest degree. Chapter 5. Leveling and Leveling Instruments. 1. I shall now treat of the ways in which water should be conducted to dwellings and cities. First comes the method of taking the level. Leveling is done either with dioptri, or with water levels, or with the chorobates, but it is done with great accuracy by means of the chorobates, because dioptri and levels are deceptive. The chorobates is a straight edge about 20 feet long. At the extremities it has legs, made exactly alike and jointed on perpendicularly to the extremities of the straight edge, and also cross pieces fastened by tenons connecting the straight edge and the legs. These cross pieces have vertical lines drawn upon them, and there are plumb lines hanging from the straight edge over each of the lines. When the straight edge is in position and the plumb lines strike both the lines alike and at the same time, they show that the instrument stands level. 2. But if the wind interposes and constant motion prevents any definite indication by the lines, then have a groove on the upper side 5 feet long, 1 digit wide, and a digit and a half deep, and pour water into it. If the water comes up uniformly to the rims of the groove, it will be known that the instrument is level. When the level is thus found by the means of the chorobates, the amount of fall will also be known. 3. Perhaps some reader of the works of Archimedes will say that there can be no true leveling by means of water, because he holds that water has not a level surface, but is of a spherical form, having its center at the center of the earth. Still, whether water is plane or spherical, it necessarily follows that when the straight edge is level, it will support the water evenly at its extremities on the right and left, but that it slopes down at one end, the water at the higher end will not reach the rim of the groove in the straight edge. For though the water, wherever poured in, must have a swelling and curvature in the center, yet the extremities on the right and left must be on a level with each other. A picture of the chorobates will be found drawn at the end of the book. If there is to be a considerable fall, the conducting of the water will be comparatively easy. but if the course is broken by depressions, we must have recourse to substructures. Chapter 6. Aqueducts, wells, and cisterns. 1. There are three methods of conducting water: in channels through masonry conduits, or in lead pipes, or in pipes of baked clay. If in conduits, let the masonry be as solid as possible, and let the bed of the channel have a gradient of not less than 1/4 inch for every 100 feet, and let the masonry structure be arched over, so that the sun may not strike the water at all. When it has reached the city, build a reservoir with a distribution tank and 3 compartments connected with the reservoir to receive the water, and let the reservoir have 3 pipes, 1 for each of the connecting tanks, so that when the water runs over from the tanks at the ends, it may run into the one between them. 2. From this central tank, pipes will be laid to all the basins and fountains. From the second tank, to baths, so that they may yield an annual income to the state, and from the third, to private houses, so that water for public use will not run short, for people will be unable to divert it if they have only their own supplies from headquarters. This is the reason why I have made these divisions, and also in order that individuals who take water into their houses may by their taxes help to maintain the conducting of the water by the contractors. 3. If, however, there are hills between the city and the source of supply, subterranean channels must be dug and brought to a level at the gradient mentioned above. If the bed is of tufa or other stone, let the channel be cut in it, but if it is of earth or sand, there must be a vaulted masonry walls for the channel, and if the water should thus be conducted, with shafts built at every 240 feet. 4. But if the water is to be conducted in lead pipes, first build a reservoir at the source, then let the pipes have an interior area corresponding to the amount of water, and lay these pipes from this reservoir to the reservoir which is inside the city walls. The pipes should be cast in lengths of at least 10 feet. If they are hundreds, they should weigh 1,200 pounds each length. If 80s, 960 pounds. If 50s, 600 pounds. 40s, 480 pounds. 30s, 360 pounds. 20s, 240 pounds. 15s, 180 pounds. 10s, 120 pounds. 8s, 100 pounds. 5s, 60 pounds. The pipes get the names of their sizes from the width of the plates taken in digits before they are rolled into tubes. Thus, when a pipe is made from a plate 50 digits in width, it will be called a 50, and so on with the rest. 5. The conducting of the water through lead pipes is to be managed as follows. If there is regular fall from the source to the city, without any intervening hills, they are high enough to interrupt it, but with depressions in it, then we must build substructures to bring it up to the level as in the case of channels and conduits. If the distance round such depressions is not great, the water may be carried round circuitously, but if the valleys are extensive, the course will be directed down their slope. On reaching the bottom, a low substructure is built so that the level there may continue as long as possible. This will form the venter, termed koilia by the Greeks. Then on reaching the hill on the opposite side, the length of the venter makes the water slow in swelling up to rise to the top of the hill. 6. But if there is no such venter made in the valleys, nor any substructure built on a level, but merely an elbow, the water will break out and burst the joints of the pipes, and in the venter, water cushions must be constructed to relieve the pressure of the air. Thus, those who have to conduct water through lead pipes will do it most successfully on these principles, because its descents, circuits, venters, and risings can be managed in this way, when the level of the fall from the sources to the city is once obtained. 7. It is also not ineffectual to build reservoirs at intervals of 24,000 feet, so that if a break occurs anywhere, it will not completely ruin the whole work, and the place where it has occurred can easily be found, but such reservoirs should not be built at a descent, nor in the plain of a venter, nor at risings, nor anywhere in valleys, but only where there is an unbroken level. 8. But if we wish to spend less money, we must proceed as follows. Clay pipes with a skin at least 2 digits thick should be made, but these pipes should be tongued at one end so that they can fit into and join one another. Their joints must be coated with quicklime mixed with oil, and at the angles at the level of the venter a piece of red tufa stone, with a hole bored through it, must be placed right at the elbow, so that the last length of pipe used in the descent is jointed into the stone, and also the first length of the level of the venter. Similarly, at the hill on the opposite side, the last length of the level of the venter should stick into the hole in the red tufa, and the first of the rise should be similarly jointed into it. 9. The level of the pipes being thus adjusted, they will not be sprung out of place by the force generated at the descent and at the rising. For a strong current of air is generated in an aqueduct which bursts its way even through stones, unless the water is let in slowly and sparingly from the source at first, and checked at the elbows or turns by bands, or by the weight of sand ballast. All the other arrangements should be made as in the case of lead pipes, and ashes are to be put in beforehand when the water is let in from the source for the first time, so that if any of the joints have not been sufficiently coated, they may be coated with ashes. 10. Clay pipes for conducting water have the following advantages. In the first place, in construction, if anything happens to them, anybody can repair the damage. Secondly, water from clay pipes is much more wholesome than that which is conducted through lead pipes, because lead is found to be harmful for the reason that white lead is derived from it, and this is said to be hurtful to the human system. Hence, if what is produced from it is harmful, no doubt the thing itself is not wholesome. 11. This we can exemplify from plumbers, since in them the natural colors of the body is replaced by a deep pallor. For when lead is smelted in casting, the fumes from it settle upon their members, and day after day burn out and take away all the virtues of the blood from their limbs. Hence, water ought by no means to be conducted in lead pipes, if we want to have it wholesome. That the taste is better when it comes from clay pipes may be proved by everyday life, for though our tables are loaded with silver vessels, yet everybody uses earthenware for the sake of purity of taste. 12. But if there are no springs from which we can construct aqueducts, it is necessary to dig wells. Now, in the digging of wells, we must not disdain reflection, but must devote much acuteness and skill to the consideration of the natural principles of things, because the earth contains many various substances in itself. For like everything else, it is composed of the four elements. In the first place, it is itself earthy, and of moisture it contains springs of water, also heat, which produces sulfur, alum, and asphalt, and finally it contains great currents of air which, coming up in a pregnant state through the porous fissures to the places where wells are being dug, and finding men engaged in digging there, stop up the breath of life in their nostrils by the natural strength of the exhalation. So those who do not quickly escape from the spot are killed there. 13. To guard against this, we must proceed as follows. Let down a lighted lamp, and if it keeps on burning, a man may make the descent without danger. But if the light is put out by the strength of the exhalation, then dig air shafts beside the well on the right and left. Thus the vapors will be carried off by the air shafts as if through nostrils. When these are finished and we come to the water, then a wall should be built round the well without stopping up the vein. 14. But if the ground is hard, or if the veins lie too deep, the water supply must be obtained from roofs or higher ground, and collected in cisterns of signinum work. Signinum work is made as follows. In the first place, procure the cleanest and sharpest sand. Break up lava into bits of not more than a pound in weight, and mix the sand in a mortar trough with the strongest lime in the proportion of 5 parts of sand to 2 of lime. The trench for the signinum work, down to the level of the proposed depth of the cistern, should be beaten with wooden beetles covered with iron. 15. Then, after having beaten the walls, let all the earth between them be cleared out to a level with the very bottom of the walls. Having evened this off, let the ground be beaten to the proper density. If such constructions are in two compartments or in three, so as to ensure clearing by changing from one to another, they will make the water much more wholesome and sweeter to use. For it will become more limpid and keep its taste without any smell, if the mud has somewhere to settle. Otherwise it will be necessary to clear it by adding salt. In this book I have put what I could about the merits and varieties of water, its usefulness and the ways in which it should be conducted and tested. In the next I shall write about the subject of dialing and the principles of timepieces. End of Book 8. Book 9 of 10 Books on Architecture. Introduction. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 9. Introduction. 1. The ancestors of the Greek have appointed such great honors for the famous athletes who are victorious at the Olympian, Pythian, Isthmian, and Nemean games, that they are not only greeted with applause as they stand with palm and crown at the meeting itself, but even on returning to their several states in the triumph of victory, they ride into their cities and to their fathers' houses in four-horse chariots, and enjoy fixed revenues for life at the public expense. When I think of this, I am amazed that the same honors and even greater are not bestowed upon those authors whose boundless services are performed for all time and for all nations. This would have been a practice all the more worth establishing, because in the case of athletes it is merely their own bodily frame that is strengthened by their training, whereas in the case of authors it is the mind, and not only their own but also man's in general, by the doctrines laid down in their books for the acquiring of knowledge and the sharpening of the intellect. 2. What does it signify to mankind that Milo of Croton and other victors of his class were invincible? Nothing, save that in their lifetime they were famous among their countrymen. But the doctrines of Pythagoras, Democritus, Plato, and Aristotle, and the daily life of other learned men, spent in constant industry, yield fresh and rich fruit not only to their own countrymen but also to all nations, and they who from their tender years are filled with plenteous learning which this fruit affords attain to the highest capacity of knowledge and can introduce into the states civilized ways, impartial justice and laws, things without which no state can be sound. 3. Since, therefore, these great benefits to individuals and to communities are due to the wisdom of authors, I think that not only should palms and crowns be bestowed upon them, but that they should even be granted triumphs and judged worthy of being consecrated in the dwellings of the gods. Of their many discoveries which have been useful for the development of human life, I will cite a few examples. On reviewing these, people will admit that honors ought of necessity to be bestowed upon them. 4. First of all, among the many very useful theorems of Plato, I will cite one as demonstrated by him. Suppose there is a place or a field in the form of a square, and we are required to double it. This has to be effected by means of lines correctly drawn, for it will take a kind of calculations not to be made by means of mere multiplication. The following is the demonstration. A square place 10 feet long and 10 feet wide gives an area of 100 feet. Now, if it is required to double the square and to make one of 200 feet, we must ask how long will be the side of that square so as to get from this the 200 feet corresponding to the doubling of the area. Nobody can find this by means of arithmetic, for if we take 14, multiplication will give 196 feet, if 15, 225 feet. 5. Therefore, since this is inexplicable by arithmetic, let a diagonal line be drawn from angle to angle of that square of 10 feet in length and width, dividing it into two triangles of equal size, each 50 feet in area. Taking this diagonal line as the length, describe another square. Thus we shall have in the larger square four triangles of the same size and the same number of feet as the two of 50 feet each, which were formed by the diagonal line in the smaller square. In this way, Plato demonstrated the doubling by means of lines, as the figure appended at the bottom of the page will show. 6. Then again, Pythagoras showed that a right angle can be formed without the contrivances of the artisan. Thus, the result which carpenters reach very laboriously, but scarcely to exactness, with their squares, can be demonstrated to perfection from the reasoning and methods of his teaching. If we take three rules, one 3 feet, the second 4 feet, and the third 5 feet in length, and join these rules together with their tips touching each other so as to make a triangular figure, they will form a right angle. Now, if a square be described on the length of each one of these rules, the square on the side of 3 feet in length will have an area of 9 feet, of 4 feet, 16, of 5, 25. 7. Thus the area in number of feet made up of two squares on the sides 3 and 4 feet in length is equaled by that of the one square described on the side of 5. When Pythagoras discovered this fact, he had no doubt that the Muses had guided him in the discovery, and it is said that he very gratefully offered sacrifice to them. This theorem affords a useful means of measuring many things, and it is particularly serviceable in the building of staircases in buildings, so that the steps may be at the proper levels. 8. Suppose the height of the story, from the flooring above to the ground below, to be divided into 3 parts. 5 of these will give the right length for the stringers of the stairway. Let 4 parts, each equal to one of the 3, composing the height between the upper story and the ground, be set off from the perpendicular, and there fix the lower ends of the stringers. In this manner the steps and the stairway itself will be properly placed. A figure of this also will be found appended below. 9. In the case of Archimedes, although he made many wonderful discoveries of diverse kinds, yet of them all the following, which I shall relate, seems to have been the result of a boundless ingenuity. Hero, after gaining the royal power in Syracuse, resolved, as a consequence of his successful exploits, to place in a certain temple a golden crown which he had vowed to the immortal gods. He contracted for its making at a fixed price, and weighed out a precise amount of gold to the contractor. At the appointed time, the latter delivered to the king's satisfaction an exquisitely finished piece of handiwork, and it appeared that in weight the crown corresponded precisely to what the gold had weighed. 10. But afterwards a charge was made that gold had been abstracted, and an equivalent weight of silver had been added in the manufacture of the crown. Hero, thinking it an outrage that he had been tricked, and yet not knowing how to detect the theft, requested Archimedes to consider the matter. The latter, while the case was still on his mind, happened to go to the bath, and on getting into a tub observed that the more his body sank into it, the more water ran out over the tub. As this pointed out the way to explain the case in question, without a moment's delay and transported with joy, he jumped out of the tub and rushed home naked, crying with a loud voice that he had found what he was seeking. For as he ran, he shouted repeatedly in Greek, "Eureka! Eureka!" 11. Taking this as the beginning of his discovery, it is said that he made 2 masses of the same weight as the crown, one of gold and the other of silver. After making them, he filled a large vessel with water to the very brim, and dropped the mass of silver into it. As much water ran out as was equal in bulk to that of the silver sunk in the vessel. Then, taking out the mass, he poured back the lost quantity of water, using a pint measure, until it was level with the brim as it had been before. Thus he found the weight of silver corresponding to a definite quantity of water. 12. After this experiment, he likewise dropped the mass of gold into the full vessel, and, on taking it out and measuring as before, found that not so much water was lost, but a smaller quantity, namely, as much less as a mass of gold lacks in bulk compared to a mass of silver of the same weight. Finally, filling the vessel again and dropping the crown itself into the same quantity of water, he found that more water ran over for the crown than for the mass of gold of the same weight. Hence, reasoning from the fact that more water was lost in the case of the crown than in that of the mass, he detected the mixing of silver with the gold, and made the theft of the contractor perfectly clear. 13. Now let us turn our thoughts to the researches of Archytas of Tarentum and Eratosthenes of Cyrene. They made many discoveries from mathematics which are welcome to men, and so, though they deserve our thanks for other discoveries, they are particularly worthy of admiration for their ideas in that field. For example, each in a different way solved the problem enjoined upon Delos by Apollo in an oracle, the doubling of the number of cubic feet in his altars. This done, he said, the inhabitants of the island would be delivered from an offense against the religion. 14. Archytas solved it by his figure of the semi-cylinders, Eratosthenes by means of the instrument called Mesolabe. Noting all these things with the great delight which learning gives, we cannot but be stirred by these discoveries when we reflect upon the influence of them one by one. I find also much for admiration in the books of Democritus on nature and in his commentary entitled Kerakmeta, in which he made use of his ring to seal with soft wax the principles which he had himself put to the test. 15. These, then, were men whose researches are an everlasting possession not only for the improvement of character, but also for general utility. The fame of athletes, however, soon declines with their bodily powers, neither when they are in the flower of their strength, nor afterwards with posterity, can they do for human life which is done by the researches of the learned. 16. But although honours are not bestowed upon authors for excellence of character and teaching, yet as their minds, naturally looking up to the higher regions of the air, are raised to the sky on the steps of history, it must needs be that not merely their doctrines, but even their appearance, should be known to posterity through time eternal. Hence, men whose souls are aroused by the delights of literature cannot but carry enshrined in their hearts the likeness of the poet Ennius, as they do those of the gods. Those who are devotedly attached to the poems of Accius seem to have before them not merely his vigorous language, but even his very figure. 17. So, too, numbers born after our time will feel as if they were discussing nature face to face with Lucretius, or the art of rhetoric with Cicero. Many of our posterity will confer with Varro on the Latin language. Likewise, there will be numerous scholars who, as they weigh many points with the wise among the Greeks, will feel as if they were carrying on private conversations with them. In a word, the opinions of learned authors, though their bodily forms are absent, gain strength as the time goes on, and, when taking part in councils and discussions, have greater weight than those of any living men. 18. Such, Caesar, are the authorities on whom I have depended, and applying their views and opinions, I have written the present books, in the first 7 treating of buildings, and in the 8th of water. In this I shall set forth the rules for dialing, showing how they are found through the shadows cast by the gnomon from the sun's rays in the firmament, and on what principles these shadows lengthen and shorten. End of Book 9, Introduction. Book 9, Chapters 1 to 2 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 1. The Zodiac and the Planets. 1. It is due to the divine intelligence, and is a very great wonder to all who reflect upon it, that the shadow of a gnomon at the equinox is of one length in Athens, and of another in Alexandria, of another in Rome, and not the same at Piacenza or at other places in the world. Hence drawings for dials are very different from one another, corresponding to the differences of situation. This is because the length of the shadow at the equinox is used in constructing the figure of the analemma, in accordance with which the hours are marked to conform to the situation and the shadow of the gnomon. The analemma is a basis for calculation deduced from the course of the sun and found by observation of the shadow as it increases until the winter solstice. By means of this, through architectural principles and the employment of the compasses, we find out the operation of the sun in the universe. 2. The word universe means the general assemblage of all nature, and it also means the heaven that is made up of the constellation and the courses of the stars. The heaven revolves steadily round earth and sea on the pivots at the ends of its axis. The architect at these points was the power of nature, and she put the pivots there to be, as it were, centers, one of them above the earth and sea at the very top of the firmament, and even beyond the stars composing the Great Bear, the other on the opposite side under the earth in the regions of the south. Round these pivots, termed in Greek poloi, as centers, like those of turning lathe, she formed the circles into which the heaven passes on its everlasting way. In the midst thereof, the earth and sea naturally occupy the central point. 3. It follows from this natural arrangement that the central point in the north is high above the earth, while on the south, the region below, it is beneath the earth and consequently hidden by it. Furthermore, across the middle, and obliquely inclined to the south, there is a broad circular belt composed of the 12 signs, whose stars, arranged in 12 equivalent divisions, represent each a shape which nature has depicted. And so with the firmament and the other constellations, they move round the earth and sea in glittering array, completing their orbits according to the spherical shape of the heaven. 4. They are all visible or invisible according to fixed times. While 6 of the signs are passing along with the heaven above the earth, the other 6 are moving under the earth and hidden by its shadow. But there are always 6 of them making their way above the earth, for corresponding to that part of the last sign which in the course of its revolution has to sink, pass under the earth, and become concealed, an equivalent part of the sign opposite to it is obliged by the law of their common revolution to pass up and, having completed its circuit, to emerge out of the darkness into the light of the open space on the other side. This is because the rising and setting of both are subject to one and the same power and law. 5. While these signs, 12 in number and occupying each 1/12th part of the firmament, steadily revolve from east to west, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, as well as Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, differing from one another in the magnitude of their orbits, as though their courses were at different points in a flight of steps, pass through those signs in just the opposite direction, from west to east, in the firmament. The Moon makes her circuit of the heaven in 28 days plus about an hour, and with her return to the sign from which she set forth completes a lunar month. 6. The Sun takes a full month to move across the space of one sign, that is, 1/12th of the firmament. Consequently, in 12 months she traverses the spaces of the 12 signs, and, on returning to the sign from which he began, completes the period of a full year. Hence, the circuit made by the Moon 13 times in 12 months is measured by the Sun only once in the same number of months. But Mercury and Venus, their paths wreathing around the Sun's rays as their center, retrograde and delay their movements, and so, from the nature of that circuit, sometimes wait at stopping places within the spaces of the signs. 7. This fact may best be recognized from Venus. When she is following the Sun, she makes her appearance in the sky after his setting, and is then called the evening star, shining most brilliantly. At other times she precedes him, rising before daybreak, and is named the morning star. Thus Mercury and Venus sometimes delay in one sign for a good many days, and at others advance pretty rapidly into another sign. They do not spend the same number of days in every sign, but the longer they have previously delayed, the more rapidly they accomplish their journeys, after passing into the next sign, and thus they complete their appointed course. Consequently, in spite of their delay in some of the signs, they nevertheless soon reach the proper place in their orbits after freeing themselves from their enforced delay. 8. Mercury, on his journey through the heavens, passes through the spaces of the signs in 360 days, and so arrives at the sign from which he set out on his course at the beginning of his revolution. His average rate of movement is such that he has about 30 days in each sign. 9. Venus, on becoming free from the hindrance of the Sun's rays, crosses the space of a sign in 30 days, though she thus stays less than 40 days in particular signs. She makes good the required amount by delaying in one sign when she comes to a pause. Therefore she completes her total revolution in heaven in 485 days, and once more enters the sign from which she previously began to move. 10. Mars, after traversing the spaces of the constellation for about 683 days, arrives at the point from which he had before set out at the beginning of his course, and while he passes through some of the signs more rapidly than others, he makes up the required number of days whenever he comes to a pause. Jupiter, climbing with gentler pace against the revolution of the firmament, travels through each sign in about 360 days, and finishes in 11 years and 313 days, returning to the sign in which he had been 12 years before. Saturn, traversing the space of one sign in 29 months plus a few days, is restored after 29 years, and about 160 days to that in which he had been 30 years before. He is, as it appears, slower, because the nearer he is to the outermost part of the firmament, the greater is the orbit through which he has to pass. 11. The three that complete their circuits above the sun's course do not make progress while they are in the triangle which he has entered, but retrograde and pause until the sun has crossed from that triangle into another sign. Some hold that this takes place because, as they say, when the sun is a great distance off, the paths on which these stars wander are without light on account of that distance, and so the darkness retards and hinders them. But I do not think that this is so. The splendor of the sun is clearly to be seen, and manifest without any kind of obscurity, throughout the whole firmament, so that those very retrograde movements and pauses of the stars are visible even to us. 12. If then, at this great distance, our human vision can discern that sight, why, pray, are we to think that the divine splendor of the stars can be cast into darkness? Rather will the following way of accounting for it prove to be correct. Heat summons and attracts everything towards itself. For instance, we see the fruits of the earth growing up high under the influence of heat, and that spring water is vaporized and drawn up on the clouds at sunrise. On the same principle, the mighty influence of the sun, with its rays diverging in the form of a triangle, attracts the stars which follow him, and, as it were, curbs and restrains those that precede, not allowing them to make progress, but obliging them to retrograde towards himself until he passes out into the sign that belongs to a different triangle. 13. Perhaps the question will be raised, why the sun by his great heat causes these detentions in the fifth sign from himself rather than in the second or third, which are nearer. I will therefore set forth what seems to be the reason. His rays diverging through the firmament in straight lines as though forming an equilateral triangle, that is, to the fifth sign from the sun, no more, no less. If his rays were diffused in circuits spreading all over the firmament instead of in straight lines diverging so as to form a triangle, they would burn up all the nearer objects. This is a fact which the Greek poet Euripides seems to have remarked, for he says that places at a greater distance from the sun are in violent heat, and that those which are nearer he keeps temperate. Thus in the play of Phaethon the poet writes, Kai ei taporo tangithen, dev ekrat eke. 14. If then fact and reason and the evidence of an ancient poet point to this explanation, I do not see why we should decide otherwise than as I have written above on this subject. Jupiter, whose orbit is between those of Mars and Saturn, traverses a longer course than Mars and a shorter than Saturn. Likewise, with the rest of these stars, the farther they are from the outermost limits of the heaven, and the nearer their orbits to the earth, the sooner they are seen to finish their courses, for those of them that have a smaller orbit often pass those that are higher, going under them. 15. For example, place 7 ants on a wheel such as potters use, having made 7 channels on the wheel about the center, increasing successively in circumference, and suppose those ants obliged to make a circuit in these channels while the wheel is turned in the opposite direction. In spite of having to move in a direction contrary to that of the wheel, the ants must necessarily complete their journeys in the opposite direction, and that ant which is nearest the center must finish its circuit sooner, while the ant that is going round at the outer edge of the disc of the wheel must, on account of the size of its circuit, be much slower in completing its course, even though it is moving just as quickly as the other. In the same way, these stars, which struggle on against the course of the firmament, are accomplishing an orbit on paths of their own, but, owing to the revolution of the heaven, they are swept back as it goes round every day. 16. The reason why some of these stars are temperate, others hot, and others cold, appears to be this, that the flame of every kind of fire rises to higher places. Consequently, the burning rays of the sun make the ether above him white-hot in the regions of the course of Mars, and so the heat of the sun makes him hot. Saturn, on the contrary, being nearest to the outermost limit of the firmament and bordering on the quarters of the heaven which are frozen, is excessively cold. Hence, Jupiter, whose course is between the orbits of these two, appears to have a moderate and very temperate influence, intermediate between their cold and heat. I have now described, as I have received them from my teacher, the belt of the 12 signs and the 7 stars that work and move in the opposite direction, with the laws and numerical relations under which they pass from sign to sign, and how they complete their orbits. I shall next speak of the waxing and waning of the moon, according to the accounts of my predecessors. Chapter 2. The Phases of the Moon. 1. According to the teaching of Berosus, who came from the state, or rather nation, of the Chaldees, and was the pioneer of Chaldean learning in Asia, the moon is a ball, one half luminous and the rest of a blue color. When, in the course of her orbit, she has passed below the disk of the sun, she is attracted by his rays in great heat, and turns thither her luminous side, on account of the sympathy between light and light. Being thus summoned by the sun's disk and facing upward, her lower half, as it is not luminous, is invisible on account of the likeness to the air. When she is perpendicular to the sun's rays, all her light is confined to her upper surface, and she is then called the new moon. 2. As she moves on, passing by to the east, the effect of the sun upon her relaxes, and the outer edge of the luminous side sheds its light upon the earth in an exceedingly thin line. This is called the second day of the moon. Day by day she is further relieved in turns, and thus are numbered the third, fourth, and following days. On the seventh day, the sun being in the west and the moon in the middle of the firmament between the east and west, she is half the extent of the firmament distant from the sun, and therefore half of the luminous side is turned toward the earth. But when the sun and moon are separate by the entire extent of the firmament, and the moon is in the east with the sun over against her in the west, she is completely relieved by her still greater distance from his rays, and so on the 14th day she is at the full, and her entire disk emits its light. On the succeeding days, up to the end of the month, she wanes daily as she turns in her course, being recalled by the sun until she comes under his disk and rays, thus completing the count of the days of the month. 3. But Aristarchus of Samos, a mathematician of great powers, has left a different explanation in his teaching on this subject, as I shall now set forth. It is no secret that the moon has no light of her own, but is, as it were, a mirror, receiving brightness from the influence of the sun. Of all the 7 stars, the moon traverses the shortest orbit, and her course is nearest to the earth. Hence, in every month, on the day before she gets past the sun, she is under the disk and rays, and is consequently hidden and invisible. When she is thus in conjunction with the sun, she is called the new moon. On the next day, reckoned as her second, she gets past the sun and shows the thin edge of her sphere. 3 days away from the sun she waxes and grows brighter, removing further every day till she reaches the seventh, when her distance from the sun at its setting is about one half the extent of the firmament, one half of her is luminous, that is, the half which faces toward the sun is lighted up by him. 4. On the 14th day, being diametrically across the whole extent of the firmament from the sun, she is at her full, and rises when the sun is setting. For, as she takes her place over against him and distant to the whole extent of the firmament, she thus receives the light from the sun throughout her entire orb. On the 17th day, at sunrise, she is inclining to the west. On the 22nd day, after sunrise, the moon is about mid-heaven. Hence, the side exposed to the sun is bright and the rest dark. Continuing thus her daily course, she passes under the rays of the sun on about the 28th day, and so completes the account of the month. I will next explain how the sun, passing through a different sign each month, causes the days and hours to increase and diminish in length. End of Book 9, Chapter 2. Book 9, Chapters 3 to 6 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 3. The Course of the Sun Through the 12 Signs. 1. The sun, after entering the sign Aries and passing through 1/8 of it, determines the vernal equinox. On reaching the tail of Taurus and the constellation of the Pleiades, from which the front half of the Taurus projects, he advances into a space greater than half the firmament, moving towards the north. From Taurus he enters Gemini at the time of the rising of the Pleiades, and getting higher above the earth he increases the length of the days. Next, coming from Gemini into Cancer, which occupies the shortest space in heaven, and after traversing 1/8 of it he determines the summer solstice. Continuing on, he reaches the head and breast of Leo, portions which are reckoned as belonging to Cancer. 2. After leaving the breast of Leo and the boundaries of Cancer, the sun, traversing the rest of Leo, makes the days shorter, diminishing the size of his circuit, and returning to the same course that he had in Gemini. Next, crossing from Leo into Virgo and advancing as far as the bosom of her garment, he still further shortens his circuit, making his course equal to what it was in Taurus. Advancing from Virgo by way of the bosom of her garment, which forms the first part of Libra, he determines the autumn equinox at the end of 1/8 of Libra. Here his course is equal to what his circuit was in the sign Aries. 3. When the sun has entered Scorpio, at the time of the setting of the Pleiades, he begins to make the days shorter as he advances toward the south. From Scorpio he enters Sagittarius, and, on reaching the thighs, his daily course is still further diminished. From the thighs of Sagittarius, which are reckoned as part of Capricornus, he reaches the end of the 1/8 of the latter, where his course in heaven is shortest. Consequently, this season, from the shortness of the day, is called Bruma, or Dies Brumalis. Crossing from Capricornus into Aquarius, he causes the days to increase to the length which they had when he was in Sagittarius. From Aquarius he enters Piscis at the time when Favonius begins to blow, and here his course is the same as in Scorpio. In this way the sun passes round through the signs, lengthening or shortening the days and hours at definite seasons. I shall next speak of the other constellations formed by arrangements of stars and lying to the right and left of the belt of the signs, in the southern and northern portion of the firmament. Chapter 4. The Northern Constellations. 1. The Great Bear, called in Greek Arctos, or Helike, has her warden behind her. Near him is the Virgin, on whose right shoulder rests a very bright star which we called Harbinger of the Vintage, and the Greeks Protrigetes. But Spica in that constellation is brighter. Opposite there is another star, colored between the knees of the bear warden, dedicated there under the name of Arcturus. 2. Opposite the head of the bear, at an angle with the feet of the twins, is the charioteer, standing on the tip of the horn of the bull. Hence one and the same star is found on the tip of the left horn of the bull and in the right foot of the charioteer. Supported on the hand of the charioteer are the kids, with the she-goat at his left shoulder. Above the bull and the ram is Perseus, having at his right, with the Pleiades moving beneath, and at his left the head of the ram. His right hand rests on the likeness of Cassiopeia, and with his left he holds the Gorgon's head by its top over the ram, laying it at the feet of Andromeda. 3. Above Andromeda are the fishes, one above her belly and the other above the backbone of the horse. A very bright star terminates both the belly of the horse and the head of Andromeda. Andromeda's right hand rests above the likeness of Cassiopeia and her left above the northern fish. The waterman's head is above that of the horse. The horse's hoofs lie close to the waterman's knees. Cassiopeia is set apart in the midst, high above the he-goat or the eagle and the dolphin, and near them is the arrow. Farther on is the bird whose right wing graces the head and scepter of Cepheus, with its left resting over Cassiopeia. Under the tail of the bird lie the feet of the horse. 4. Above the archer, scorpion, and balance is the serpent, reaching to the crown with the end of its snout. Next, the serpent holder grasps the serpent above the middle in his hands, and with his left foot treads squarely on the foreparts of the scorpion. A little way from the head of the serpent holder is the head of the so-called kneeler. Their heads are the more readily to be distinguished, as the stars which compose them are by no means dim. 5. The foot of the kneeler rests on the temple of the serpent, which is entwined between the she-bears, called Septentrionus. The little dolphin moves in front of the horse. Opposite the bill of the bird is the lyre. The crown is arranged between the shoulders of the warden and the kneeler. In the northern circle are the two she-bears, with their shoulder blades confronting and their breasts turned away from one another. The Greeks called the lesser bear Kynosaura and the greater Elike. Their heads face different ways, and their tails are shaped so that each is in front of the head of the other bear, for the tails of both stick up over them. 6. The serpent is said to lie stretched out between their tails, and in it there is a star, called Pollux, shining near the head of the greater bear. At the nearest point, the serpent winds its head round, but is also flung in a fold round the head of the lesser bear and stretches out close to her feet. Here it twists back, making another fold, and, lifting itself up, bends its snout and right temple from the head of the lesser bear round towards the greater. Above the tail of the lesser bear are the feet of Cepheus, and at this point, at the very top, are stars forming an equilateral triangle. There are a good many stars common to the lesser bear and the Cepheus. I have now mentioned the constellations, which are arranged in the heaven to the right of the east, between the belt of the signs and the north. I shall next describe those that nature has distributed to the left of the east and the southern regions. Chapter 5. The Southern Constellations. 1. First, under the he-goat lies the southern fish, facing towards the tail of the whale. The censer is under the scorpion's sting. The foreparts of the canthar are next to the balance and the scorpion, and he holds in his hands the figure which astronomers call the beast. Beneath the virgin, lion, and crab is the twisted girdle formed by the snake. Extending over a whole line of stars, his snout raised near the crab, supporting the bowl with the middle of his body near the lion, and bringing his tail, on which is the raven, under and near the hand of the virgin. The region above his shoulders is equally bright. 2. Beneath the snake's belly, at the tail, lies the centaur. Near the bowl and the lion is the ship named Argo. Her bow is invisible, but her mast and the parts above the helm are in plain sight, the stern of the vessel joining the dog at the tip of his tail. The little dog follows the twins, and is opposite the snake's head. The greater dog follows the lesser. Orion lies aslant, under the bull's hoof, in his left hand grasping his club and raising the other towards the twins. 3. At his feet is the dog, following a little behind the hare. The whale lies under the ram and the fishes, and from his mane there is a slight sprinkling of stars, called in Greek harpedonai, regularly disposed towards each of the fishes. This ligature by which they hang is carried a great way inwards, but reaches out to the top of the mane of the whale. The river, formed of stars, flows from a source at the left foot of Orion. But the water, said to pour from the waterman, flows between the head of the southern fish and the tail of the whale. 4. These constellations, whose outlines and shapes in the heavens were designed by nature and the divine intelligence, I have described according to the view of the natural philosopher Democritus, but only those whose rising and settings we can observe and see with our own eyes. Just as the bears turn round the pivot of the axis without ever setting or sinking under the earth, there are likewise stars that keep turning round the southern pivot, which, on account of the inclination of the firmament, lies always under the earth, and being hidden there, they never rise and emerge above the earth. Consequently, the figures which they form are unknown to us on account of the interposition of the earth. The star Canopus proves this. It is unknown to our vicinity, but we have reports of it from merchants who have been to the most distant parts of Egypt and to regions bordering on the uttermost boundaries of the earth. Chapter 6. Astrology and Weather Prognostics. 1. I have shown how the firmament and the 12 signs with the constellation arranged to the north and south of them fly round the earth, so that the matter may be clearly understood. For it is from this revolution of the firmament, from the course of the sun through the signs in the opposite direction, and from the shadows cast by equinoctial gnomons, that we find the figure of the analemma. 2. As for the branch of astronomy which concerns the influences of 12 signs, the 5 stars, the sun, and the moon upon human life, we must leave all this to the calculations of the Chaldeans, to whom belongs the art of casting nativities, which enables them to declare the past and the future by means of calculations based on the stars. These discoveries have been transmitted by the men of genius and great acuteness who sprang directly from the nations of the Chaldeans, first of all by Berosus, who settled in the island state of Kos, and there opened a school. Afterwards Antipater pursued the subject, then there was Archinapolis, who also left rules for casting nativities, based not on the moment of birth, but on that of conception. 3. When we come to the natural philosophy, however, Thales of Miletus, Anaxagoras of Clazomenae, Pythagoras of Samos, Xenophanes of Colophon, and Democritus of Abdera have in various ways investigated and left us the laws and the working of the laws by which nature governs it. In the track of their discoveries, Evdoxus, Evctemon, Callippus, Meto, Philippus, Hipparchus, Aratus, and others discover the risings and settings of the constellations as well as weather prognostications from astronomy through the study of the calendars, and this study they set forth and left to posterity. Their learning deserves the admiration of mankind, for they were so solicitous as even to be able to predict long beforehand with divining mind the signs of the weather which was to follow in the future. On this subject, therefore, reference must be made to their labors and investigations. End of Book 9, Chapter 6. Book 9, Chapters 7 and 8 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 7. The Analemma and its Applications. 1. In distinction from the subjects first mentioned, we must ourselves explain the principles which govern the shortening and lengthening of the day. When the sun is at the equinoxes, that is, passing through Aries or Libra, he makes the gnomon cast a shadow equal to 8/9 of its own length in the latitude of Rome. In Athens the shadows is equal to 3/4 of the length of the gnomon, at Rhodes to 5/7, at Tarentum to 9/11, at Alexandria to 3/5, and so at other places it is found that the shadows of equinoctial gnomons are naturally different from one another. 2. Hence, wherever a sundial is to be constructed, we must take the equinoctial shadow of the place. If it is found to be, as in Rome, equal to 8/9 of the gnomon, let a line be drawn on a plane surface, and in the middle thereof erect a perpendicular, plumb to the line, which perpendicular is called the gnomon. Then, from the line in the plane, let the line of the gnomon be divided off by compasses into 9 parts, and take the point designating the 9th part as a center to be marked by the letter A. Then, opening the compasses from the center to the line in the plane at the point B, describe a circle. This circle is called the meridian. 3. Then, on the 9 parts between the plane and the center of the gnomon, take 8 and mark them off on the line in the plane to the point C. This will be the equinoctial shadow of the gnomon. From that point, marked by C, let a line be drawn through the center at the point A, and this will represent a ray of the sun at the equinox. Then, extending the compasses from the center to the line in the plane, mark off the equidistant points E on the left and I on the right on the 2 sides of the circumference, and let a line be drawn through the center dividing the circle into 2 equal semicircles. This line is called by mathematicians the horizon. 4. Then, take a 15th part of the entire circumference and, placing the center of the compasses on the circumference at the point where the equinoctial ray cuts it at the letter F, mark off the points G and H on the right and left. Then lines must be drawn from these and the center to the line of the plane at the points T and R, and thus one will represent the ray of the sun in winter and the other the ray in summer. Opposite E will be the point I, where the line drawn through the center at the point A cuts the circumference. Opposite G and H will be the points L and K, and opposite C, F and A will be the point N. 5. Then, diameters are to be drawn from G to L and from H to K. The upper will denote the summer and the lower the winter portion. These diameters are to be divided equally in the middle at the points M and O and those centers marked. Then, through these marks and the center A, draw a line extending to the two sides of the circumference at the points P and Q. This will be a line perpendicular to the equinoctial ray, and it is called in mathematical figures the axis. From these same centers, open the compasses to the ends of the diameters and describe semicircles, one of which will be for summer and the other for winter. 6. Then, at the points at which the parallel lines cut the line called the horizon, the letter S is to be on the right and the letter V on the left, and from the extremity of the semicircle at the point G, draw a line parallel to the axis extending to the left-hand semicircle at the point H. This parallel line is called the logotomus. Then, center the compasses at the point where the equinoctial ray cuts that line at the letter D and open them to the point where the summer ray cuts the circumference at the letter H. From the equinoctial center, with radius extending to the summer ray, describe the circumference of the circle of the months, which is called Meneus. Thus we shall have the figure of the analemma. 7. This having been drawn and completed, the scheme of hours is next to be drawn on the base plates from the analemma, according to the winter lines, or those of summer, or the equinoxes, or the months. And thus many different kinds of dials may be laid down and drawn by this ingenious method. But the result of all these shapes and designs is in one respect the same, namely, the days of the equinoxes and of the winter and summer solstices are always divided into 12 equal parts. Omitting details, therefore, not for fear of the trouble, but lest I should prove tiresome by writing too much, I will state by whom the different classes and designs of dials have been invented. For I cannot invent new kinds myself at this late day, nor do I think that I ought to display the inventions of others as my own. Hence I will mention those that have come down to us and by whom they were invented. Chapter 8. Sundials and water clocks. 1. The semicircular form, hollowed out of a square block and cut under to correspond to the polar altitude, is said to have been invented by Berosus the Chaldean. The scaph or hemisphere by Aristarchus of Samos, as well as the disc on a plane surface. The arachne by the astronomer Evdoxus, or, as some say, by Apollonius. The plinthium or lacunar, like the one placed in the Circus Flaminius, by Scopinus of Syracuse. The prosta historomena, by Parmenio. The pros pan clima, by Theodosius and Andreas. The pelicinum, by Patroclus. The cone, by Dionysus Dorus. The quiver, by Apollonius. The men whose names are written above, as well as many others, have invented and left us other kinds, as, for instance, the conarachne, the conical plinthium, and the antiborion. Many have also left us written directions for making dials of these kinds for travelers, which can be hung up. Whoever wishes to find their base plates can easily do so from the books of these writers, provided only he understands the figure of the analemma. 2. Methods of making water clocks have been investigated by the same writers, and first of all by Ctesibius the Alexandrian, who also discovered the natural pressure of the air and pneumatic principles. It is worthwhile for students to know how these discoveries came about. Ctesibius, born at Alexandria, was the son of a barber. Preeminent for natural ability and great industry, he is said to have amused himself with ingenious devices. For example, wishing to hang a mirror in his father's shop in such a way that, on being lowered and raised again, its weight should be raised by means of a concealed cord, he employed the following mechanical contrivance. 3. Under the roof beam he fixed a wooden channel in which he arranged a block of pulleys. He carried the cord along the channel to the corner where he set up some small piping. Into this a leaden ball attached to the cord was made to descend. As the weight fell into the narrow limits of the pipe, it naturally compressed the enclosed air, and as its fall was rapid, it forced the mass of compressed air through the outlet into the open air, thus producing a distinct sound by the concussion. 4. Hence, Ctesibius, observing that sounds and tones were produced by the contact between the free air and that which was forced from the pipe, made use of this principle in the construction of the first water organs. He also devised methods of raising water, automatic contrivances, and amusing things of many kinds, including among them the construction of water clocks. He began by making an orifice in a piece of gold or by perforating a gem, because these substances are not worn by the action of water, and do not collect dirt so as to get stopped up. 5. A regular flow of water through the orifice raises an inverted bowl, called by the mechanicians the cork or drum. To this are attached a rack and a revolving drum, both fitted with teeth at regular intervals. These teeth, acting upon one another, induce a measured revolution and movement. Other racks and other drums, similarly toothed and subject to the same motion, give rise by the revolution to various kinds of motions by which figures are moved, cones revolve, pebbles or eggs fall, trumpets sound, and other incidental effects take place. 6. The hours are marked in these clocks on a column or a pilaster, and a figure emerging from the bottom points to them with a rod throughout the whole day. Their decrease or increase in length with the different days and months must be adjusted by inserting or withdrawing wedges. The shut-offs for regulating the water are constructed as follows. 2 cones are made, one solid and the other hollow, turned on a lathe so that one will go into the other and fit it perfectly. A rod is used to loosen or to bring them together, thus causing the water to flow rapidly or slowly into the vessels. According to these rules and by this mechanism, water clocks may be constructed for use in winter. 7. But it proves that the shortening or lengthening of the day is not in agreement with the insertion and removal of the wedges, because the wedges may very often cause errors. The following arrangement will have to be made. Let the hours be marked off transversely on the column from the analemma, and let the lines of the months also be marked upon the column. Then let the column be made to revolve in such a way that, as it turns continuously towards the figure and the rod with which the emerging figure points to the hours, it may make the hours short or long according to the respective months. 8. There is also another kind of winter dial called the anaphoric and constructed in the following way. The hours, indicated by bronze rods in accordance with the figure of the analemma, radiate from a center on the face. Circles are described upon it, marking the limits of the months. Behind these rods there is a drum, on which is drawn and painted the firmament with the circle of the signs. In drawing the figures of the 12 celestial signs, one is represented larger and the next smaller, proceeding from the center. Into the back of the drum, in the middle, a revolving axis is inserted, and round that axis is wound a flexible bronze chain, at one end, at which hangs the cork which is raised by the water, and at the other a counterpoise of sand, equal in weight to the cork. 9. Hence the sand sinks as the cork is raised by the water, and in sinking turns the axis, and the axis the drum. The revolution of this drum causes sometimes a larger and sometimes a smaller portion of the circle of the signs to indicate, during the revolution, the proper length of the hours corresponding to their seasons. For in every one of the signs there are as many holes as the corresponding month has days, and a boss, which seems to be holding the representation of the sun on the dial, designates the spaces for the hours. This, as it is carried from hole to hole, completes the circuit of a full month. 10. Hence, just as the sun, during his passage through the constellations, makes the days and hours longer or shorter, so the boss on a dial, moving from point to point in a direction contrary to that of the revolution of the drum in the middle, is carried day by day, sometimes over wider and sometimes over narrower spaces, giving a representation of hours and days within the limits of each month. To manage the water so that it may flow regularly, we must proceed as follows. 11. Inside, behind the face of the dial, place a reservoir and let the water run down into it through a pipe, and let it have a hole at the bottom. Fastened to it is a bronze drum with an opening through which the water flows into it from the reservoir. Enclosed in this drum there is a smaller one, the two being perfectly jointed together by tenon and socket, in such a way that the smaller drum revolves closely but easily in the larger, like a stopcock. 12. On the lip of the larger drum there are 365 points, marked off at equal intervals. The rim of the smaller one has a tongue fixed on its circumference with the tip directed towards those points, and also in this rim is a small opening through which water runs into the drum and keeps the works going. The figures of the celestial signs being on the lip of the larger drum and this drum being motionless, let the sign Cancer be drawn at the top, with Capricornus perpendicular to it at the bottom, Libra at the spectator's right, Aries at his left, and let the other signs be given places between them as they are seen in the heavens. 12. Hence, when the sun is in Capricornus, the tongue on the rim touches every day one of the points in Capricornus on the lip of the large drum, and is perpendicular to the strong pressure of this running water. So the water is quickly driven through the opening in the rim to the inside of the vessel, which, receiving it and soon becoming full, shortens and diminishes the length of the days and hours. But then, owing to the daily revolution of the smaller drum, its tongue reaches the points in Aquarius, the opening will no longer be perpendicular, and the water must give up its vigorous flow and run in a slower stream. Thus, the less velocity with which the vessel receives the water, the more the length of the days is increased. 14. Then the opening in the rim passes from point to point in Aquarius and Pisces as though going upstairs, and when it reaches the end of the first eighth of Aries, the fall of the water is of medium strength, indicating the equinoctial hours. From Aries the opening passes, with the revolution of the drum, through Taurus and Gemini to the highest points at the end of the first eighth of Cancer, and when it reaches that point the power diminishes, and hence, with a slower flow, its delay lengthens the days in the sign Cancer, producing the hours of the summer solstice. From Cancer it begins to decline, and during its return it passes through Leo and Virgo to the points at the end of the first eighth of Libra, gradually shortening and diminishing the length of the hours until it becomes to the points in Libra, where it makes the hours equinoctial once more. 15. Finally, the opening comes down more rapidly through Scorpio and Sagittarius, and on its return from its revolution to the end of the first eighth of Capricornus, the velocity of the stream renews once more the short hours of the winter solstice. The rules and forms of construction employed in designing dials have now been described as well as I could. It remains to give an account of machines and their principles. In order to make my treatise on architecture complete, I will begin to write on this subject in the following book. End of Book 9. Book 10, Introduction and Chapter 1 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 10, Introduction. 1. In the famous and important Greek city of Ephesus, there is said to be an ancient ancestral law, the terms of which are severe, but its justice is not inequitable. When an architect accepts the charge of a public work, he has to promise what the cost of it will be. His estimate is handed to the magistrate, and his property is pledged as security until the work is done. When it is finished, if the outlay agrees with his statement, he is complimented by decrees and marks of honor. If no more than a fourth has to be added to his estimate, it is furnished by the treasury and no penalty is inflicted. But when more than one fourth has to be spent in addition on the work, the money required to finish it is taken from his property. 2. Would to God that this were also law of the Roman people, not merely for public but also for private buildings. For the ignorant would no longer run riot with impunity, but men who are well qualified by an exact scientific training would unquestionably adopt the profession of architecture. gentlemen would not be misled into limitless and prodigal expenditure, even to ejectments from their estates, and the architects themselves could be forced, by fear of the penalty, to be more careful in calculating and stating the limit of expense, so that gentlemen would procure their buildings for that which they had expected, or by adding only a little more. It is true that men who can afford to devote 400,000 to a work may hold on, if they have to add another 100,000, from the pleasure which the hope of finishing it gives them. But if they are loaded with a 50% increase, or with an even greater expense, they lose hope, sacrifice what they have already spent, and are compelled to leave off, broken in fortune and in spirit. 3. This fault appears not only in the matter of buildings, but also in the shows given by magistrates, whether of gladiators in the forum or of plays on the stage. Here neither delay nor postponement is permissible, but the necessity of the case required that everything should be ready at a fixed time, the seats for the audience, the awning drawn over them, and whatever, in accordance with the customs of the stage, is provided by machinery to please the eye of the people. These matters require careful thought and planning by a well-trained intellect, for none of them can be accomplished without machinery, and without hard study skillfully applied in various ways. 4. Therefore, since such are our traditions and established practices, it is obviously fitting that the plans should be worked out carefully, and with the greatest attention, before the structures are begun. Consequently, as we have no law or customary practice to compel this, and as every year both praetors and aediles have to provide machinery for the festivals, I have thought it not out of place, Emperor, since I have treated of buildings in the earlier books, to set forth and teach in this, which forms the final conclusion of my treatise, the principles which govern machines. Chapter 1. Machines and Implements. 1. A machine is a combination of timbers fastened together, chiefly efficacious in moving great weights. Such a machine is set in motion on scientific principles and circular rounds, which the Greek call kyklike kineos. There is, however, a class intended for climbing, termed in Greek akrobatikon, another worked by air, which with them is called pneumatikon, and a third for hoisting, this the Greeks named barolkos. In the climbing class are machines so disposed that one can safely climb up high by means of timbers set up on end and connected by crossbeams in order to view operations. In the pneumatic class, air is forced by pressure to produce sounds and tones as in an organon. 2. In the hoisting class, heavy weights are removed by machines which raise them up and set them in position. The climbing machines display no scientific principle but merely a spirit of daring. It is held together by dowels and crossbeams and twisted lashings and supporting props. A machine that gets its motive power by pneumatic pressure will produce pretty effects by scientific refinements, but the hoisting machine has opportunities for usefulness which are greater and full of grandeur, and it is of the highest efficacy when used with intelligence. 3. Some of these act on the principles of the mechane, others on that of the organon. The difference between machines and engines is obviously this, that machines need more workmen and greater power to make them take effect, as for instance ballistae and the beams of presses. Engines, on the other hand, accomplish their purpose at the intelligent touch of a single workman, as the Scorpio or Anisocyclae when they are turned. Therefore, engines, as well as machines, are in principle practical necessities without which nothing can be unattended with difficulties. 4. All machinery is derived from nature, and is founded on the teaching and instruction of the revolution of the firmament. Let us but consider the connected revolutions of the sun, the moon, and the five planets, without their revolution of which, due to mechanism, we should not have had the alternation of day and night, nor the ripening of fruits. Thus, when our ancestors had seen that this was so, they took their models from nature, and by imitating them were led on by divine facts, until they perfected their contrivances which are so serviceable in our life. Some things, with a view to a greater convenience, they worked out by means of machines and their revolutions, others by means of engines, and so whatever they found to be useful for investigations, for the arts, and for the established practices, they took care to improve step by step on scientific principles. 5. Let us first take a necessary invention, such as clothing, and see how the combination of warp and woof on the loom, which does its work on the principle of an engine, not only protects the body by covering it, but also gives it honorable apparel. We should not have food in abundance unless yokes and ploughs for oxen and for all draught animals had been invented. If there had been no provision of windlasses, press beams, and levers for presses, we could not have had the shining oil, nor the fruit of the vine, to give us pleasure, and these things could not be transported on land without the invention of the mechanism of carts or wagons, nor on the sea without that of ships. 6. The discovery of the method of testing weights by steel yards and balances saves us from fraud by introducing honest practices into life. There are also innumerable ways of employing machinery about which it seems unnecessary to speak, since they are at hand every day, such as mills, blacksmiths, bellows, carriages, gigs, turning lathes, and other things which are habitually used as general conveniences. Hence, we shall begin by explaining those that rarely come to hand, so that they may be understood. End of Book 10, Chapter 1.
...89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority. But with AI tools popping up everywhere, how do you separate the helpful from the hype? The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at one-third of Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With over 15 years of experience building responsible, secure AI, Grammarly isn't just another AI communication assistant. It's how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. Designed to fit the needs of business, Grammarly is backed by a user-first privacy policy and industry-leading security credentials. This means you won't have to worry about the safety of your company information. Grammarly also emphasizes responsible AI, so your company can avoid harmful bias. See why 70,000 teams and 30 million people trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise. That's grammarly.com/enterprise. Grammarly, enterprise-ready AI.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.